From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 439, Windows 10 Recap with guest Paul Thurrott, recorded Friday, September 4th, 2015. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today, well, we could read his Wikipedia page, but that wouldn't be small. It's Paul Thurrott, the award-winning technology journalist and blogger with over 20 years of industry experience and the author of 25 books and a constant stream of stuff.
Like vindictive Twitter diatribe.
So much stuff. Well, I look forward to your emails. There's usually something clever there, dude. Like, I really appreciate the stuff you make. And over it, I should call out being a part of Petri IT Knowledge Base, because that's relatively recent.
That's right. Yeah, I switched over this year.
Well, congratulations. Nice bunch of people. I've had an opportunity to be drinking with a number of them over the years.
So have I.
Oddly enough. Yes. In fact, I think the last time I saw you, you were sinking into a chair beside Leo Laporte with a nice glass of scotch.
I wanted to thank you for introducing the term Abelor into my family. And it's been a source of many a late night bad decision.
Oh, nice. Yeah. A whole lot of poor adult decision making. I actually have gotten a couple of nice notes from the Abelor Twitter account before the sheer number of people that have asked me, what was that scotch again?
And so it keeps coming up and they notice, like, who is this guy who keeps tweeting about us?
And he keeps asking, why are all these people asking that guy about us?
Yep.
You make one, you know, Windows Weekly about scotch and here you go.
Downward spiral ever since.
It was like 90 seconds, but well, you guys put a pretty good dent in the bottle that day.
Yeah. You know, it's like when you hand a child chocolate for the first time and they're like, huh? I didn't even know that part of my tongue existed. Thank you for this.
You just sort of sat back and shot. I think you actually said, oh, this is my jam.
Yeah, it was. I had that kind of Gollum precious thing going on. I started nervously eyeing everyone else.
Well, and I noticed that Leo put the bottle away at the end of the recording session. I think he picked that one up immediately and stashed it somewhere in his office.
Oh, it's like children. It's the highest highs and the lowest lows.
There you go. Is it my imagination or has Microsoft had a really good year?
Yeah.
After a lot of bad years.
Right. I was going to say, especially within context, you know, the last 3 years have not been overly positive.
Well, I would take, you know, we're recording this in early September, publishing in late September of 2015. So I think back to like September, October, 2011. The original build.
Yep.
That was a scary time for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you have based your career on this stuff. And it looking at that, it's like, really?
Wow. Is this who we're going to be?
Really? Really? You know? I mean, surely. No. This is it.
This is what it's going to be now, huh?
Okay.
So, yeah, and that was the beginning. That was really Windows 8's big coming out party. And I was appreciative of the idea that they were going to do something new and they were trying to push the envelope. It looked very V1 to me. Mm-hmm. And of course, a bunch of fixes came along, but
they never really got rid of the key UIs, right? I mean, they never really improved them dramatically. The conversation I remember from that event was I was talking with the UX guys. And I said, listen, I need to document this stuff. So I need to know what the names of things are.
Right.
And what their actual, you know, what is this thing? You know, so the big one was Charms, you know.
Yep.
I said, so the Charms, the Charms menu, you know, nope, it's just Charms. And I said, right. But do you consider it kind of a menu or a, nope, just Charms. And I said, guys, no, Charms are things that go into breakfast cereal.
Yes.
You know, we need to. Really? You know, and I think there was a fundamental disconnect from day one that made this kind of maddening, you know?
Well, and clearly they had come up with a bunch of design language, but I don't know if they'd communicated it well. They certainly didn't communicate with the rest of the world well, but, you know, they were changing so many things. I don't think they had a chance to really bake a lot of the thinking around all of that.
Well, and doubly confusing, if you were following Windows Phone before that happened, I mean, you could see exactly what had happened there. And by the way, this is absolutely true, where, you know, the Windows team went to Windows Phone and said, "We're going to do something like this. Give us what you got." And then they never collaborated again.
Huh.
And you know, you've got these things that are very similar. Sometimes they're the same. Sometimes they're very different. And you could make the argument, you know, in some cases, obviously, a PC or tablet OS might need different things than a phone, and that's fine. But you know, these things then continued to develop separately, and they had different names for things, different ways of doing things. Sharing, in particular, the construct for sharing underneath the covers, very different between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Just a lot of hubris, bad decisions, you know, just from day one. It was too bad.
So do we lay all this at Sanofsky's feet? Is that inappropriate?
Yeah, we do.
And then he was gone.
And actually, you know, this is very interesting, because 3 years ago, this month-ish, next month, I guess, going into the launch of Windows 8 and the launch of Surface, the original Surface devices, Microsoft knew that this was going to be a disaster. Steven Sanofsky knew that he had been laid off.
He knew.
Yep. And had to get up on stage and talk about this event. It's fascinating to go back and look at the keynote for the Windows 8 launch with those understandings,
that knowledge.
This thing was a train wreck that they could not stop. This thing was never going to be, you know, they couldn't push it off, couldn't change it. They had to go to market. All of their partners hated this product, which you could see by the, you know, very traditional PCs that they released. Not a lot of touch going on, not a lot of innovation in device form factors. You know, it's just an amazing series of events that led to that moment.
In that sense, it is like Vista, because Vista was clearly a product that was not ready to be shipped, but they had to ship it in November of 2006. Because of the volume license agreements.
And you know, obviously the circumstances are slightly different, but the end result is the same. You know, in Vista's case, they had been working on Longhorn for so many years. Jim Altshuler had come to Bill Gates and said, this cannot happen. You know, they had developed all of the little parts of Longhorn separately. They were kind of compiling them and checking. And when they threw them into one big stew, it didn't work.
Right.
And, you know, the product that we know as Windows Vista was the result of approximately 1 year of development. It was a very different thing than all of those promises.
And they did get it right. But at that point, it was too late.
Yeah. And, you know, and by the way, the big similarity, I think, between Windows Vista and Windows 8, which, by the way, is a positive thing, is that they got the foundational stuff right, enabling the next version to be pretty stellar.
It'd be great. Yeah. And I think, you know, the funny part is I've got a couple of my main workstations running the fully up to patched up version of 8.1 with all the updates. And they work so well now, I keep forgetting I'm running 8. It just works. Like, it just sort of dropped into the background. And I'm looking at the USB key with my Win 10 license on it and going, am I ready for the disruption that it takes to take this machine that I'm recording the show on apart to do an OS upgrade? That's not a small thing to do. And a
potential disaster.
Yeah. You know? I'm not going to be able to record for a few weeks.
Yeah. Well, Windows 8.1 got to a good place. I think from the perspective of a desktop PC user, the only thing that was really missing, at least for me, was those full screen apps. And obviously with a third party utility, you could take care of that problem. Some people, it would be the start menu. I don't really use the start menu.
No, I didn't use it in 7. Switched
to using the taskbar. Yeah, I mean, the start menu for me is search. You know, it's just where I go last resort.
As long as you don't break I hit a Windows key and type NO and Notepad comes up. That's the thing you're not supposed to break, which one of the betas of Win 10 was broken.
Yes.
But, you know, those sorts of ingredients are fine. As long as you ignored Metro apps, which is basically what I ended up doing.
Yeah, you weren't alone.
Win 8 just became Windows. You just stopped thinking about it.
And, you know, I would say, not that this probably makes a difference for the machine you're doing the podcast on, but for a lot of people, those Metro apps, which are now universal apps, are going to be kind of interesting, because there's some pretty good ones in this release. And I think they're a little, you know, they're not as full featured as the desktop apps of yore or whatever, but they're getting there. They're certainly better than they were in the kind of cartoonish Fisher Price type style they had with the initial release of
Windows. Oh, for sure. Well, and yeah. If I'm an IT guy looking at my organization, trying to decide on an OS and so forth, I've learned to watch how Microsoft bets on their own products. For me, the biggest indictment of Win 8 is that Office did not come. It never came to play.
Yeah, and they talked about it.
Yeah, but it never showed up. So in a lot of ways, I think it's very reasonable for me to sit back and say, show me Office 2016. If you believe in Windows 10 enough that your Office team bet on it, I'll believe.
That's really interesting because it kind of corresponds to what I said about them knowing that this was a train wreck and they knew that they would be apologizing for and fixing Windows 8 from day one. Hmm. And I think they all took a step back and said, okay, how do we make this right? And it took them, it took them a couple of years, or a year and a half maybe, to get it to a place I think was more acceptable.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to ignore the store. I just have. There's been other ways to do things, if I'm leading a company and a company's infrastructure, I want the store's really useful. I mean, that's a safe place to get software, which is a pretty big deal. Like that to me is compelling that I would want. I believe, and it was for Cinevich that really turned me onto this. I believe in this idea of the whitelist approach to software versus the blacklist approach to software.
Absolutely. And I think the big benefit to the store for end users has yet to come, and that's going to be these kind of app-based desktop apps that are also known good. And we'll see how the performance goes in that stuff. But I mean, that's basically what Office was doing a couple of years ago. I think it's a well-known thing in the enterprise, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to turn up the volume on the store a bit. And then for businesses, of course, the ability to get your own stuff in there as well and provide a portal for your employees of, not just known good software, but here's the stuff that we use for work. And here's the stuff, we kind of recommend as well that, might just help, utilities or whatever that are good for what we're doing.
Make you more productive and so on. And my customers working in big enterprises have had that built for years that we're using group policy. We have all this complexity. We manage our updates and we manage our software blocks and so forth, but it's just not manageable when you're a one man shop, when you're a smaller business.
Right.
The idea that we could provide this via the cloud and make it a little more feasible for small organizations to have that level of reliability for software, I think is really compelling.
Yep.
I just don't know if they're even working on it that way yet.
Well, I don't know. This stuff takes a while. There's a lot of things in Windows 10 that would benefit businesses that aren't quite there yet. Windows Update for Business, for example. And the continuing notion of taking things that were on-prem and making them cloud services. It kind of started with Intune for management.
Right.
First of PCs and then devices. You can see Windows Update for Business is kind of WSUS as a service in some ways. This stuff takes some time. I think the foundational work is all there in Windows. It's just a matter of getting the stuff on the back end to happen. They clearly sped up the delivery time for Windows 10. I think that made it a little strange because we're in that nebulous period between the soft launch in July, essentially, and what I think of as the real launch, which is like October, November, when we hit what they originally intended Windows 10 to be. And what they're calling Threshold 2 now.
Right. Well, and I think it's an interesting point, this idea that they put it out in July so that they would get the back-to-school market. Is that really – you buy that?
Yep. Yeah. That's – by the way, we had been hearing for a long time that October was the launch. And suddenly it was July, and the reaction was very swift. There's no way they can do this, And I talked to Dell. It's funny. A lot of my conversations with PC companies – they assume that I know some inside information.
Yeah, Microsoft told you everything.
Yeah, I hear this a lot. I heard this week with Lenovo. You're like, about that event in October, right? Yeah, yes, of course I do. And then it kind of goes from there. And they said, well, as Microsoft was originally launching this in October, but then they told us to scramble for July. They wanted to hit the back of the school market. And I was like, yeah, I'd heard that, it's this interesting, it's kind of casually thrown out, but it all does correspond with what we had heard, and that makes sense. And it explains why the PC makers had last year's computers, but with Windows 10 instead of brand new designs. And if you think about what happened this week or is happening right now at IFA as we record this, lots of new devices are coming out for the holiday season, for the end of the year. across all markets. And that's the stuff that would have been there for in the October. Originally planned launch.
Yeah, in some ways, they've sort of sabotaged their October event now because people are sort of scrambling to where's your Win 10 offering because of the July announcements.
Yeah. But, you know, it gives them kind of a nice staged rollout because it turns July into something for upgraders and enthusiasts, which I think is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then it gives those companies the same amount of time they were always going to have new products in the market for the holiday season, October, November-ish, which was always the plan. So they don't have to speed up development of anything. They don't have to change their schedule. And so, you know, we'll see how it all works out in the wash. I mean, obviously, there are big questions around the PC market and whether we've plateaued or whether it falls more. And, you know, we'll see what the net effect eventually is of Windows 10.
Yeah, I wonder if it wouldn't be better in some ways. I mean, the stuff I've seen coming out of IFA, it's not shipping yet, but it's clearly finished product. And maybe they're just going into manufacturing, but you get a feel for it. It's kind of nice to see it and go, okay, I could order this in the next 6 weeks or 8 weeks.
Oh, no, there's a lead time on hardware that just doesn't exist with software. And even actually Dell in that same conversation said, you know, there's only so fast a factory can run, and planes can only fly so fast.
Yeah.
Containers only
move so quickly. So
The world happens, and we put stuff in planes, we ship it around the world, and it takes some time.
And that's exactly how all that works. Hey, Paul, give me 1 second here to pay the bills, because Run As Radio is brought to you by ScriptRock, the makers of Guardrail and the fighters of Configuration Drift. Configuration Drift happens in every environment from 5 nodes to 5,000. Guardrail will find and scan the configs of every node in your environment, no matter the platform, and alert you to changes happening across machines. Give it a try for 3 months free with the coupon code RUNASRADIO, all one word, at ScriptRock.com/RUNASRADIO. Is it fun to be on the other side of the table here, dude? I get to be the interviewer this time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little tired of my own voice, but sure,
no problem. Now I think we're going to call this the resonance show between you and me. We hit these serious bass tones. It's funny to have them both there at the same time. Been watching Server 2016 with some interest. Of course, I'm a web performance guy, so the whole configuration as code Docker thing is a big deal in my world. What are you looking at?
I look at Windows Server 2016 in the same context of what I was just talking about, taking on-prem and bringing it to the cloud.
Right.
You know, obviously, there are going to be places where they need on-prem servers, but it's going to be less and less. And a lot of what you see there is stuff like what you see in Office 365, where you can take part of it out and say, look, we've got this service called OneDrive for Business, and you can use it with on-prem because this is the low-hanging fruit. We used to think it was email, but now we know it's storage. Keep your on-prem stuff, but for storage and for SharePoint, go to the cloud. And so I think when I look at what they're doing in Server 2016, I see containers, and I see integration with online services, and it's sort of like a not so subtle version of let's start turning out the lights that make the most sense first as we move forward, you know, and push stuff to the cloud. So
when virtualization really took a hold of the data center. We were turning off racks of machines.
Right.
You know,
and now what we're doing is turning off the rooms that those machines are in, right? And increasingly, I'm not always, you know, again, not always, but hybrid deployments where it's your own data center and public or private cloud, it's sort of inevitable. And I always tell the big story I have about this stuff is really about Exchange, but it kind of just speaks generally to this trend is from a pre-tech ed conference probably several years ago now, where someone basically said to me, you mean to tell me that my final act as an Exchange administrator will be to shut the lights off on my on-prem server, move it off the cloud, off to the cloud, and then I shut the door and walk home because they don't need me anymore? And, you know, there are thoughtful responses to that question because what he's saying is technically true. But then, and I don't mean to, and I don't say this in a snarky or sarcastic sense, but anyone who gets involved with IT should know that they're in an ever-changing market, always have been, always will be. And that part of the deal is you need to keep learning new skills and that these things evolve and you need to evolve with them.
Right. And, Exchange always needs to be administered.
Yes, but, yes.
If you're still thinking that racking servers is an important part of your job, you've got issues.
Right, right. And, you know, and that's increasingly true, you know, moving forward. Maybe a couple of years ago it wasn't as true. Maybe a couple of years from now people will say, wait, what did we used to do? You know. I mean, it's like, you know, my kids believe that the world was actually black and white when I was a child.
Right.
You know, because that's what they see on TV.
That's it. And that's all the photos they've got, right?
Yeah.
But I do think the IT job only gets more interesting. It's just you can't keep doing the same old things. There once was a time when provisioning a user was a full-time job.
Yes.
You know?
Years ago, and I'm going to have a trouble coming up with the exact version of Windows Server this was, but it was a small business server version that will tell you how long ago it was. It might have been the last one or the second or the last one that was called Small Business Server.
Yeah.
I asked them then why any small business would provision a server under a desk or in a closet or something at some location. It seemed to me that even then, years ago, it was time to start thinking about putting this stuff up on the internet at whatever. We didn't really call it the cloud then. And that's the way things would go. And when you look at startups, we were really small businesses of just a couple of guys. There's no office, or maybe they have a shared office space like you see increasingly.
Yeah.
In this kind of everything is like a sharing economy. No one's thinking about putting a small business server, an Exchange server, or whatever under a desk. You know, no one even thinks that way.
No, it's a whole company run on laptops and the cloud.
Yeah. And, you know, granted, it's not Fortune 500, but to a generation of people that are coming up out of school, what they know is Apple devices, Google Cloud services. And, you know, this is a scary trend for Microsoft because they're not necessarily part of the picture.
Yeah.
And their products need to adapt to this world as well, to this reality, you know.
Yeah, to support that model in a logical way.
Yeah, yeah. And there's no company, and there never will be, that can handle this transition better than Microsoft because they have that experience on the on-prem side. They have incredible experience on the cloud side. They can offer unique hybrid solutions that no one else can do.
Well, and I think there's this idea that the hybrid is permanent. You will you'll always be hybrid.
Right, right. For all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
Regulatory, whatever.
Yeah, just this idea that I'd rather have a presence of authentication on-prem.
Right.
And these days, that machine could be really, really small. Like, that's not a beige box on your counter.
Although, by the way, what you just said, you know, presence authentication, is that how you said it?
Yeah.
Is today's version of rolling out users on an AD box, you know? So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not disagreeing, but you have to wonder in a couple of years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, whether the view on that changes too.
Yeah. I mean, well, it comes down to trusting connectivity. And, you know, I've had a year, I don't know if this has happened to you recently, I've had a year of wondering how much my experience is actually holding me back. You know,
this whole
chicks dig scars thing is fine. But at the same time, it's like, no, I still don't trust my connectivity deep down. And I realize there's a generation of IT folks coming in that do.
Where are the guys that know how to fix the car? And we don't, you know, to the coming generation that turns the key and has an automatic shift, that we're dinosaurs.
Right.
You know,
let's face it. Cars are dramatically better. They just don't need much fixing anymore, which is good because they're pretty much unfixable.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes. Well, you know, the way you fix a car is you do a brain transplant.
You know,
it's an all or nothing, which is a completely different issue about waste and whatnot. But, you know, fair enough.
Yeah. And there's solutions to that as well. But it's like the path to reliability, which is a worthy path, sometimes takes away this. When they weren't reliable, we made them easy to repair. Now that they are reliable, they don't need to be easy to repair.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's fair.
Well, I certainly look at that from an electronics point of view. I'm a discrete electronics guy. I'm that old. I actually aligned disk drives and got paid to do it.
That's fantastic. You know,
and repaired computers. They're not repairable anymore. I still build my own, but I admit to being a shade tree mechanic because it's a pleasure, not because it's smart.
It's a hobbyist thing.
Yeah. Almost. And it gives me an overhead. I'm responsible for those machines. They need care and feeding that only I can give.
Right.
You know, but you know what's creeping into my life? Those little Intel NUCs.
I know.
Because they're beautiful.
They are.
And they're completely unserviceable. If that breaks, you toss it.
But, you know, you're talking about a device that costs a couple $100.
Yes.
And so that's the trade-off. It's like a TV. You know, in the 1970s, 80s, you'd go to Sears, you'd buy a TV that lasts for 20 years.
Yep.
Now you go to, I almost said CompUSA. Now you go to Costco. You don't go to CompUSA. You go to Costco and you buy a off-brand Korean, whatever it is, and it costs a couple $100.
Right.
And it lasts, if you get, you know, a couple years out of it.
Good enough.
Done.
You know, it's that little explanation says so much, because you're no longer going to a specialty retailer. You're going to the bulk seller.
Like this. Which is the internet of retail stores, right? I mean, when you think about it, Walmart or Costco. Yeah.
That's what it's really done. So I've never felt like we're not, as IT people, not going to have a role, but figuring out what that role is going to be, like how I get ready for, you know, this next shift, how I actually keep my company ahead of the curve or doing well in this space.
Exactly.
It's a tough thing to think about.
Actually, so it's funny because there are two parts to this. I talked about the exchange guy. You know, it's hard for someone like that to make good decisions for their company when those decisions might impact your job.
Yes.
You know, that's one aspect of it. But if obviously the goal in IT is always to get to this point where you're being proactive rather than reactive. And I think, you know, through today, most of IT activities have been, fixing fires and doing all that kind of stuff. Being able to actually, you know, provide value to your company and make good decisions about technology and be the guy, the go-to guy for that kind of stuff, I think should be the goal. But it requires a little bit of work on your part to understand how things are going and where your own infrastructure can change for the better and what role you might play in that. It's such an awful thing in some ways to a responsibility because it's so easy to make the wrong choice.
Sure. But I also feel like we have been able to make choices based on products for a long time.
Yep.
You know, we've described them as an exchange admin, but it's not true anymore. You know, it really, you want to think of it more in terms of, you know, responsibilities around messaging because it's a broader concept and it actually is more important to the organization long term.
Yeah, it's all this. And again, I keep going back to Office 365, but it's a really good example. And of course, you just said Exchange anyway. So, you know, in the past, from Microsoft's perspective, the customer had Exchange, it was never clear or obvious or possible even that they might have SharePoint, that they might have Link or Office Communication Server, whatever it was before. And that you know, they would develop these things in silos. And today, because of Office 365, because of the way things are changing, you have more of an opportunity to create these kind of holistic products that take into account all of this stuff and that you know that they're going to have that other stuff. And it changes everything. And of course, on the flip side, it changes what your skill set needs to be as well if you're the person maintaining or administering that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt, you just have to, be a part of the thinking where all of those things are going to go.
Yeah.
You know, the volume license agreement was a brilliant move, and I'm pretty sure it was Ballmer's move because it meant that.
Sure.
You knew they owned everything, right? Now the Microsoft sales guys, you know, the relationship guy for that organization was about you lighting up the licenses you owned.
Right.
And this is Office 365 has become almost the same thing. Well, if you've bought this subscription, you own all this stuff. Yeah. Are you using it properly? Like, if you actually engage with it?
The answer is no.
No, of course not.
You know, in most cases, and that's what's interesting, you know. Just educating people about, did you know
you own this?
That, yeah, you have Link and you guys can have online meetings and you can, you know, you can communicate with your external workers. This is a new world for a lot of people.
And I think a lot of, you know, Office 365 is one of those things that people generally are resisting. Why would I do that? So, you know, for me, and you go back and look at the catalog of Run As Radio, there's a lot of shows we're talking about. What's the thing that gets you, you know, what's the first hit that gets you into Office 365 so that all those other decisions happen? I mean, Exchange has been an obvious one. I did a show a while ago on Exchange Online Protection, which is still, that's just spam filtering and proxying for your on-prem Exchange, although it'll also work just fine for your cloud Exchange at $1 per mailbox per month. And I'm like, dude, that's crack. That's just evil. You know, because it's irresistible for the price to offload that traffic and back up your mail and so forth. And then once you own that, well, here comes that slippery slope.
Yeah. I mean, Exchange is the obvious one because everyone needs email. But I mean, depending on the business type, I would point to things like SharePoint and OneDrive for Business as that tipping point where the value is just so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we also have to kind of, maybe you won't agree with this one, but kind of cure the enterprise of the stranglehold on what gets upgraded. I mean, I personally believe that one of the nice things about Office 365 is that it does move forward at a predictable pace and that you get new capabilities as time goes on.
No, and that I didn't strangle upgrading because I don't like upgrades. I strangled upgrading because I didn't like stuff being broken. It ruined my weekend.
The reason things would have broken in the past, by and large, aside from just pure bugs or whatever, mm-hmm. was that we were deploying this stuff locally.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
You had Pareto's law, right? I roll out an update to 1,000 machines, 800 of them work fine, 200 of them don't. I then do the first fix to the rollout for that 200, and 160 of them take the fix and are fine, and 40 of them aren't. And after about the third or fourth iteration, those last machines are really broken.
Right.
But it's been a whole weekend at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, by the way, that's IT nightmare in a nutshell. I mean,
that's my whole life. That's why that's a lot of gray hair.
You've had a great career, man. I don't know why you're complaining, but you like this stuff. Don't even pretend you don't. I like the idea of getting IT into this kind of a different mindset where it's not that kind of experience and where you can actually start thinking about doing the right thing. This mentality sort of started with SharePoint in a way because it was this notion of letting the users do their own little, I can roll up my own little site for my team and I can do this stuff. I don't have to get admin approval. I mean, I think this
virus that is SharePoint, you mean that thing?
What's that?
The virus that is SharePoint.
Yes, the virus that is SharePoint. But you would see it that way because it represents a loosening of control.
Yes.
You know, which I think a lot of IT admins naturally would, rail against. Of course, these are the guys that were walking around squirting super glue into USB ports.
It was epoxy actually, but yes.
Yeah.
done it.
Yeah.
All right. And cut the wires in the back. I've done everything you can think of to try and get people,
while they were using the computer.
What's interesting about SharePoint is given the choice between people locally installing SharePoint in a beige box under the desk and signing up a SharePoint online account, I'd rather the online account.
Oh, God. Every time. Yeah. SharePoint administration is a nightmare.
Oh.
A nightmare.
I have had the experience of us rolling out Map to just find out how many installations of SharePoint there actually are in this organization.
And that's going to be a frightening moment when that little tally comes up.
Oh, it's just inventorying software in larger organizations can be hilarious. We found a WebSphere or installation in a company that shall remain nameless
awesome.
You guys have a WebSphere installation. And like, we don't own any WebSphere.
That's fantastic.
It was 12 machines. This was not a little WebSphere installation.
Oh, that's good.
These things happen. It definitely is part of the adventure. I appreciate you coming and spend some time with me, man. It's fun to have a little recap, sort of think through that story arc that is the state of affairs right now.
Hey, we live in amazing times. We really do.
I totally agree. And Microsoft's had a good year. I'm interested to see what happens next.
I think it looks good. I mean, I'm really eager to see the new devices that are coming out soon, phones and tablets. Mm-hmm. Really interested to see what they do with Windows 10 and with Server and with Office. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff coming. I think the next year is going to be pretty great too.
I'm still not sure what I want to do with tablets and enterprise, but that is a whole other conversation.
Oh, we'll have to have that sometime.
I think so. Paul Theroux, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.